Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Ilson, and we're set, as usual, for our Sunday morning show. And we're going to talk baseball. You know, the end of the season is not too far away, and there are still some races that are very, very important. For example, Bob Lemon has taken the New York Yankees right up there where they're in contention, where a few weeks ago they looked like they were out of it. California and Kansas City are still in a battle. The Giants, although they've dropped off, they picked up a game the other night. I think they're 3 or 3.5 out. But anyway, baseball has had a fantastic season attendance-wise and will probably break all records. We're going to talk baseball today with one of my closest friends in baseball. I worked for him for a number of years, and I think he's the best-informed man in baseball. I know this about Frank Lane. He works harder at it than any executive I have run across in my 40 years in the big leagues. So we have many, many things to talk about with Frank Lane, and he'll be with us in just a moment. We're delighted to have Frank Lane as our guest today. I'm interviewing him on this bright Sunday for about the 200th time over the last 40 years, and he always makes a great guest. Frank, today, with sports overlapping the way it does, one season and the other, do you think there's an oversaturation of professional sports in the big cities?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. There's just so much money that the public has to spend on sports. And the ticket prices have gone up out of sight to meet the expense of the exorbitant salaries that all players are getting, baseball, basketball, football. And when you have, for instance, here's the city, Baltimore was known as a good sports town. I have known from my own private experience. And we had to win the pennant in Baltimore to draw 1 million people. They had pro football, they had basketball, and all around. I just think there's just too much professional sports. And the fans, he always judges his idea by his own pocketbook. And when he has to go out and spend $8 to get a ticket that he used to get for $3.50 to $4, he knows where it's going. It's going in the pockets of the athletes. The athletes are overpaid. Now, the salaries that they are paying nowadays is a true representation of what they're due them. Then they must have been vastly underpaid in previous years. I'm not one of these kind of guys in the good old days, because right now we're selling baseball today, we're selling football today, basketball today. But I do think, from my own experience, that they're getting so much more money than they're entitled to. Well, I'll just take a case in point. Lyman Bostock, our right fielder at California Angels.
I forgot to mention that Mr. Lane is a super scout for the California club and works for a good friend of mine, Gene Autry. Go on with your story.
So the thing is that, for instance, Bostock, last year, his salary with Minnesota was $20,000. This year, we are paying him $450,000. Now, tell me what manner of logic, if there is such a thing as logic in baseball, could that man be promoted or advanced in salary from $20,000 one year to $450,000, particularly since the intervening period had snow and ice? We didn't play any ball in December, January, and February, but when he quit the service of the Twins in the end of the 1977 season, he was getting $20,000. He opened the season with us, getting $450,000 a year. Well, I blame the owners. Now, Mr. Wrigley was not one of my favorite people, but there's a lot of things that he did fine. And if the other owners would operate their ball club like Mr. Wrigley did, he felt that he owned a ball club and he had a right to say what he'll pay. And he didn't believe that a ball player or any employee with the gum company, they'll come in and say, this is what you'll give me or else. Well, he let him, or else he got rid of Rick Mundy, who's a fine ball player, because he felt that Rick Mundy getting about $150,000 is well, he was getting well paid. Bill Matlock, the third baseman, was getting about $105,000. He got rid of Bill Matlock to the San Francisco. And Matlock told me, he said, Mr. Lane, he said, I'd have been glad to stay here for $125,000. He said, Mr. Wrigley let me go before I even found out what I wanted. I said, well, you fellas, if you've all gotten so greedy, I'm just afraid you're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. There's just so much money you can take out of baseball.
Frank, why is it, I'm talking to you now as a baseball man and as a businessman, why is it that over all the years, sports writers, radio announcers, baseball announcers refer to the fact that within the framework of baseball, there's always been such a lack of logic?
Well, there's a lack of logic in any enterprise, for that matter. The common horse sense is something seldom used, and certainly not in baseball. But I'll tell you what it is. Owning a ball club is an ego trip. It's certainly not a baseball. It's not a business thing. It's the most unbusiness-like business in the world. For instance, at the start of the year, we obligate ourselves to spend $6 million for ball players on salaries and things like that before we know what we're going to take in dollar one. Now, for instance, out at California last year, our gross intake was $8 million. And we only had two or three of the expensive ball players, the salary. And we lost $600,000. It used to be you could draw 800,000 people and break even. But they got all out of proportion. They wanted to keep ahead of the Joneses. Now, the fellow down at Arlington, Texas, whom you know, a fine young businessman, Brad Corbett, he had about $6 million invested in that ball club. He would like to sell it, but he's got an obligation of about $8 million more. No club's going to buy that because they'll have to assume that obligation. I've talked about the money. For instance, when I see a lineman Bostock, I'm not running down Bostock. I'm more power to him. If the owners are stupid enough to spend it and pay that kind of money, fine, they should take it. But slowly but surely, it's going to dawn on them within 1, 2, or 3 years when 3 or 4 ball clubs go over the roadside and go bankrupt. And then they'll start getting back. I predict that within 2, 3 years, we're going to have 2 8-club leagues. And then we'll be back on a healthy basis, money-wise and ballplayers-wise. See, back when I first started in this thing, we only had 16 major league clubs, 8 in the American League, 8 in the National League. We had 62 minor leagues contributing talent to those 16 clubs. Now we've got 26 major leagues. We've only got 14 minor leagues contributing talent. That's the reason now they're employing ball players, 38, 39, 40 years old. I remember that when I was running a ball club, I used to get down and look over the age. I said, geez, so-and-so is going to be 29 years old, going to be 30. I had to get ready to get a replacement. When they hit 30, they're about through. Now you got guys playing 38, 39, 40. Campaneris was signed to a 6-year contract by the Texas club. He admitted to being 36 years old. He was signed to a 5-year contract. And I told Brad Corbett, the president of the club, I said, boy, you're getting an expensive night watch. I mean, what are you talking about? As you think that Campaneris is going to be able to cavort around shortstop when he's 40, 41 years old? You could get him for a cheese sandwich right now. They just haven't used good common sense, but it is an ego trip. And they, for instance, Brad Corbett's a fine young businessman. He lived in Brooklyn. He had a great idea about this electronic tubing. He told me he borrowed the $35 bus fare to go to Fort Worth. He interested the small business corporation out there in supporting his activity. It built up Robin Tech Company. Now the fans, the people that he associated with Brooklyn didn't know anything about him. But the best way for them to know that he's successful is buy a ball club. Then you pick up when they see their name in a headline, brother. That's got them hypnotized, and they're paying for it. They could get advertising much more cheaply than spending $6 million for a ball club that they shouldn't have paid for.
Frank Lane, there's always much comment, much debate over managers, whether this manager is good, what he can do, what he's supposed to do. Hypothetically, you've got let's say you're not associated with the California club, but you now become general manager of another ball club next year. What one manager would you prefer to have? Who, in your opinion, is the outstanding manager in the big league?
Earl Weaver. I'd associated with him 8 years. Earl Weaver, probably one of the most hated young managers in baseball. I knew him when he managed at Elmira, then at Rochester, then in Baltimore. He was about 2 innings ahead of the other manager. They hated his guts. I would pick him, and proof of the pudding is He's got the best winning percentage of any manager now managing in baseball. And you know why? He worked at it. When I'd go to Baltimore after a trip, I was sort of a would-be super scout for them. And Earl sat down, he said, come on, I want to pick your brain. It didn't take him long to pick my brain. But at any rate, he'd ask me about different clubs, and he worked at it. Now the manager, they all have public relations and publicity departments, and they furnish stats to the manager. Very few of the managers pay any attention. They say, well, that's something to use instead of toilet paper. They just didn't think that the stats meant anything. But Earl Weaver worked at it. And that's the mark of genius. Hell, Mr. Ricker used to talk about luck. There's no such thing as luck. Luck is the residue of design. You work at it. And you make your own luck. And Weaver did it. I watched Weaver from the time he was at Elmira, then at Rochester, then at Baltimore. He is the best manager, and he's got results. He takes and adapts his style to what he's got. He doesn't have an outstanding ball club at Baltimore, but he's got two or three good hitters, but he always comes up with good pitching, and he's just about an inning ahead of the other manager. I'd take him in a minute if I could get him.
While you're on the subject of managers, how do you foresee, let's review the situation in Chicago, the Cubs and the White Sox. Now, Vec is not the type of guy to stand still. What do you foresee his doing out there over the winter?
Well, you know he's going to get a new manager. Bill doesn't stand still, and all due respect to Dobie, managers are no better than the ball players they're given to manage. And Bill is in the process of building a baseball club. I sat with him last night. I tell you, the most optimistic thing I can say about his ball club, he's got four or five young pitchers that are going to come through, and the name of the game is pitching. Pitching is 75 to 80% of the game, and I'd say of these young pitchers, and some have shown great promise, and I think that's the future lies in his pitching. But somebody asked me what makes great managers. I said great ball players. Tell me a guy who's a great manager with bad ball players. He might get a little bit more out of it, win one or more, two or three or more or five ball games than another manager. But he still has something to work on.
Frank, what do you foresee for the Cubs?
Well, I love Bob Kennedy. Bob Kennedy played for me. And when I took over the Cleveland Club, he was working the Cleveland Playground. And I brought him into the office there. And he and Hoot Evers did a hell of a job for me. Tremendous. And I think he's one of the top guys. I would say that if I had a ball club and Kennedy was in the front office, I'd make him the manager. He's got good baseball sense, his logic, and he likes ball players. You know, you'd be surprised how many managers get mad at ball players.
Have a doghouse.
And they have a doghouse. And any manager has a doghouse, everything to do with him. Because it's a sense that just the way he wreaks his feelings on a player that's at his mercy. And to start with, the managers are the worst judge of ball players. They got the worst seat in the house in the dugout. They see it at an angle. I had, when I run the Kansas City Club, I had Joe Gordon get up in the press box. He said, boy, you can see it here, but he says, I got to get back in the dugout. I just feel like I'm not in the ballgame. But they have the worst place in the world to judge ball players. But I would say that Bob Kennedy is a top baseball man, and he could manage for me anytime. Not just general management, but manage, because he appreciates that the ball players are human, and he treats them accordingly. Not saying that Herman Franks doesn't, but Herman, I would think, if he was a young, struggling manager and wasn't so well and financially fixed as he is, he'd be a better manager. But right now, Herman's worth $3, 4, or 5 million, they tell me. So he thinks, well, why should I pay any attention to that bum up there? I could buy and sell him. That's not that bum up there is the guy that's paying his salary, whether he likes him or not. If without that bum up there, they don't need Herman Franks. And Herman Franks does know baseball, and I think he'd be a better baseball man if he didn't have as much money as he's got.
Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is one of the best informed men in baseball, in my opinion. And I know he's one of the hardest working. That's Frank Lane, Super Scout for California. We'll be back with our guest in just a moment. I've always enjoyed Frank Lane. I'll tell you one thing about Lane. He'll give you an honest answer anytime. He's very, very candid. There's no bunk about him. And that's the way he operated when he operated in baseball. And I think it paid off, because everybody that I've run across in baseball over these many, many years has a great amount of respect for him. Frank, let's take a look back over the years and some of the people that you've known very well that our listeners don't know, maybe I don't even know too well, who have made great contributions to the game. Some people say, writers say, if Judge Landis were alive, he couldn't be commissioner today because times have changed.
Well, I happen to know, and you probably know, that I knew Judge Landis very well personally. Originally, my association with him started when I was called to the office to answer charges against the Cincinnati Club because Larry McPhail never thought there was a rule made that he couldn't break. And as a consequence, I was his assistant, and I had to go up and answer for the things that Larry didn't do in accordance with the rules. And I got to know the judge very well. And, in fact, I enjoyed so much, we'd walk up and down Michigan Boulevard for about an hour and a half. And one of the things that he hated the most was the farm system. Anything that was associated with Branch Rickey, who was the father of the farm system, which was really a savior for poor ball clubs because they couldn't buy their ball players, so they spawned them and developed them. And McPhail had been a disciple of Branch Rickey. And I learned more baseball in 1 minute from Branch Rickey than I learned years from other people. But he despised the farm system. He said, here's a fellow signs a contract, and he signed it for $50 to $75 a month. And in those days, kids were glad to get $15 a week. Back in my day, they'd say, well, when I get 15 a week, I'm going to have enough to get married. You can't buy your meals today for $15. But Landis, I knew Landis. He came in. He was really the savior of baseball because it fell in pretty evil ways. The White Sox scandal in 1919. I say Landis and Babe Ruth were the saviors of baseball. And Landis had all the guts in the world. He fined Standard Oil $29 million. I think he collected 29 cents. He was a tremendous actor, but the public had great respect for him, and I know that, in fact, the matter is one of the things that I don't like to recall is the fact that Buck Weaver, who was ruled as being a member of the Black Sox, well, he wasn't. Buck Weaver, I didn't know Buck Weaver at first, but I was a Cincinnati fan. I remember paying a quarter sitting in the bleachers, and Honey Grohl was my greatest idol. He tremendous ball player, lived at President. Now the 1919 World Series going, and Buck Weaver is playing third base for the visiting White Sox. And I thought, well, there's nobody going to equal. Buck Weaver made some of the greatest plays at 340 and out of this world. Yet he was ruled out because he had guilty knowledge. Guilty knowledge of what was going on. And in those days, I would say, and you remember now, when you were going to school as a kid, the worst thing you could say about somebody, he's a snitch. So I happened to be, when I later got into baseball and I come to Chicago, I said, nobody could ever make me believe that Buck Weaver had any part in the dishonest dealings of the White Sox. And I said, he was too great a man, and I had never known Buck. And one day, some fellow stopped me on this. He said, Mr. Lane, I got to thank you. Somebody had published it. And I said, well, that was my feelings. I knew. And he said, Frank, I didn't know a damn thing about it. I wasn't involved in it, but I knew that was going on. But he said, the commissioner threw us out because we had guilty knowledge, and we had guilty knowledge. We didn't come up and tell the owners and tell the league president, and that they were involved because they didn't let me know or let the president of the league or the president of the ball club know. In fact, he said they let a couple of the presidents know, but the president of the ball club didn't want to say anything about it because he'd lose some good ball players. But Buck Weaver, in my book, that was a miscarriage of justice. Joe Jackson hit 400. He could hardly write his own name. He didn't know what was going on, but he was a great ball player. Now, if he was getting money out of the thing and getting paid for not doing a good job, all he did was hit 400. And Buck Weaver hit about 350.
that's really a great story. I want to talk to you just a couple of minutes about one of the most different sort of incidents that ever happened in baseball. It involves Bill Veeck and a midget by the name of Goodell. Where were you the night that Eddie Goodell went to bat at St. Louis?
Well, I wasn't there. and I tell you, Bill's a great guy for different things, as you know, and a tremendous promoter. And Bill always comes up with original ideas. In fact, I thought I had done a pretty good job with the White Sox because we took over